Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Hey everybody, this is Andy, and welcome to this week's episode of Registry Matters. Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you, our amazing listeners, for your generous support. Your contributions make this podcast possible, and we're incredibly grateful to everyone who has chosen to support us. If you haven't yet contributed, we encourage you to join in and make a difference. It's simple. Just visit registrymatters.co and click Become a Patron. Supporting us is easy and hassle-free. At Registry Matters and FYB Education, we are passionate about the issues we discuss. We know these topics profoundly affect your life as a PFR, as well as the lives of countless other PFRs and their families. Our mission is to create meaningful change and reshape the conversation around this vital issue. You can be confident that every donation goes directly towards sustaining our modest operation. We prioritize efficiency and frugality. There's no first-class travel, no fancy dinners, and no extravagant spending. Your support helps us focus on what truly matters, delivering valuable content and advocating for change. Before we get started, here's a quick reminder. Transitioning from a Registry Matters listener to a supporter is just a click away. Visit registrymatters.co and hit Become a Patron. Your support means the world to us. Now, let's get the show started. And thank you for being here. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and I guess with an extra East in there, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 322 of Registry Matters. Larry, is it 7,000 below zero, or is it an inferno over there at the moment?
It was actually a beautiful day. We had, I think, in the low 60s, clear, and you couldn't ask for a nicer fall day.
Fantastic. This always turns out to be the start of it's weather matters in the Midwest there. I'm sorry, Southwest there. We probably should move on and find something more to talk about. Should we talk about presidential appointments to cabinet seats?
No, we'll save that for next week because there won't be many people listening the next week, so we'll save it for that.
All right, well, please head over. Oh, wait, oh my God, BFR soldiers here. Welcome, you haven't been here in ages. Please go over and press like, subscribe, do all those things, and recommend us to tell all your friends. Larry, I'm wearing a t-shirt tonight for Amplified Voices. I was a guest on their podcast last night at the Parsol conference. We can get into that a little bit later. Wanted to make sure to give a shout out to them that I was giving a little bit of a couple minute wrap up and so showing them some support. Go over there and listen to their show. They're like the kind of touchy feely kind of thing where they tell stories.
Oh, I can't wait to be a part of that.
we may end up being over there. So anywho, search for Registry Matters in your favorite podcast app or find us on YouTube. And so from there, what are we doing tonight?
Chance is not able to be with us again and probably won't be with us again until December. He's dealing with family matters. Again, it's just Mr. Gloom and Doom for this episode. And we were going to follow up on a case from West Virginia Supreme Court where I got a scathing phone call, but we've kicked that down the road. We have a discussion about the Parsol conference and a special guest named John from that organization, PARSOL. And we have a full segment of Larry's general rules for successful living. And if time permits, we were going to take a dive into the state of New Mexico's legislative elections and the upcoming session. Oh, and we have a question from a listener named Matthew.
We do. It's so funny, Larry. We were chatting with Matthew last week, and just a piece of advice for you. No matter what your level of speaking ability is, I did this at the Parsol conferences. I like kind of formulated my question and I threw it into ChatGPT and I said, please clean this up, make it more clear, make it flow, and poof, you'll hear that question here in a little bit. So I suggested that Matthew do the same thing. And here is his question. Why is it that an average individual accused of a PFR type crime, if convicted, is typically required to register as a PFR, while high-profile figures, such as politicians, often face no criminal charges despite similar allegations? Public figures like Clinton, Biden, Trump, Gates have faced accusations that frequently result in civil suits or financial settlements rather than criminal prosecution or even PFR registration. What factors contribute to this disparity in legal and social outcomes between public officials and private citizens? Furthermore, is there a legal pathway or precedent that would allow individuals currently on PFR registries to seek a reevaluation of their cases based on similar principles applied to public figures? Wow, that's kind of cool. That's kind of deep and nerdy.
It's actually a great question, and we could do an episode on this, but we don't have time to even do an episode. So let me focus on the last part of the question, because it was so easy. There is virtually no way to seek a reevaluation of their cases based on similar principles applied to public figures, because we're going to get into those principles here in a minute or two. But the people who already have existing criminal convictions, the pathway towards reevaluation of those cases is very narrow. And it will probably become more narrow as we go forward, because of the recent elections, there will probably be efforts to make it so that the post-conviction relief is even further restricted. But in terms of the first part of the question, public figures like Clinton, Biden, Trump, and Gates, now he's talking about Congressman, former Congressman Matthew Gates, I'm assuming, and he's talking about the current president and two former presidents. Well, let's get rid of Clinton first. There were no accusations of criminality whatsoever with Clinton. So it was easy to screen that case out. He was not accused of criminal conduct. He was accused of unethical conduct by having an affair with an adult intern in the White House, and he disparaged the Oval Office by doing naughty, naughty things in the Oval Office. So that takes care of Mr. Clinton. Do you agree with what I've said there, so we can move on to Mr. Biden?
Yeah, I mean, he had an adult relationship. What he got nailed up, jammed up for was lying about it.
That is correct. President Biden, to my knowledge, has never been accused of any sexual impropriety. If you listen to the Dan Bongino show, he does get accused of sniffing children, and he gets accused of being gross. There's something weird about that.
Creepy.
Yeah, he's accused of a creep, but that's not criminal behavior. So we can take President Biden out. President-elect Trump has been accused of sexual improprieties, but there are things that prevent prosecution, like the statute of limitations. And I know that Matthew would believe in the statute of limitations. He would not want to disregard protections, equal protection of the law for Mr. Trump. So there was no pathway in the New York case for criminal prosecution. So the only pathway was the civil remedy, and he was found civilly liable. And that doesn't carry registration with it. But now be careful what you ask for, folks. If you believe that someone who has had a finding of civil liability against them, you just may rue the day that you made that your priority, because in a civil setting, the standard of proof, the burden of proof is far lower. It's preponderance versus beyond a reasonable doubt. You do not have a constitutional right to free representation if you can't afford it. So folks, when you're hoping that kind of thing happens, just remember that the hope that you think you have will not be nearly as funny when it happens to one of your loved ones. Because putting people on the registry who have been convicted at a much lower standard and who didn't have the opportunity to have a non-paid attorney if they couldn't afford one, that would not be a pretty sight. So we can take Mr. Trump out. Mr. Gates there's a report that's going to be forthcoming. I suspect the United States Senate's going to want to take a look at that report. And we have yet to know if any of those allegations have significant evidence to support them. Mr. Gates, despite whether I like him or not, has the right to the presumption of innocence and due process of law. And he will, depending on what the report says, he may have to withdraw his name. The president-elect may have to withdraw him from consideration as the attorney general designee. But that's something that's still unfolding. But in terms of the difference in disparity, their cases are screened for how strong and reliable the evidence that would convict the person. Do they have sufficient evidence? Do they have credible witnesses? Is the evidence viable enough that you could secure a conviction? And I hate to admit this, but how robust of a defense someone can put up also goes into the equation, meaning that a person who has fewer resources is a more vulnerable target. Mr. Trump has always been a formidable opponent because he has access to resources, and he's demonstrated it quite well that he's been able to use the judicial system like nobody in my entire lifetime. And I go back 183 years.
Correct.
And he has
verified. We have a birth certificate for that.
Yes. And he has been able to show with adequate resources and funding, you can put up an enormous fight. The average person doesn't have that. So if I'm a prosecutor, I'm going to be a little bit hesitant to bring criminal charges against someone like Trump unless I have overwhelming evidence. And that doesn't include hearsay, speculation, innuendo, and all that stuff. Evidence is solid. What is it? Incontrovertible evidence that will hold up under the cross-examination and the rigorous defense that someone could put forward. And so the difference is, we have a systemic difference in terms of American justice. People who have more money get a more robust defense. That shouldn't surprise you. People who have more money get better medical care. People who have more money get better college educations. People who have more money get to live in nicer homes. What surprises people about having more money lends itself to a better outcome? Are you surprised?
No, not at all. It's not. It's a very unfortunate situation, but that's just not how, especially in a capitalistic society, that's just what it is.
Well, what would we do about it? Let's just say that we wanted to fix it. Can you think of any quick options you could throw out there of how we could fix this? Oh, I got an idea. We could confiscate the resources from the people who have money. And oh, that's kind of socialistic. We can't do that.
I was going to say we could just fund the public defender's office at a, like, not extreme, but at a sufficient enough level that everyone, you just kind of round robin through enough people that everyone has an equal level of defense. And that's who your defense attorney is, period.
Even if you have your own financial resources.
Correct. That's just what you get. End of story.
That won't ever pass in a free society.
I know.
Because people have the right to spend their money. But what are the options? I've got it. We could force private members of the private defense bar, we can confiscate their labor and their financial resources and force them to pay for the experts that would be needed to rebut the vastly superior forensics evidence and the resources that the state and the prosecution have. That's an idea. Oh, well, that wouldn't go either because we're not allowed to. Folks, there are few options for resolving this dilemma. It's a fact of life that people who have lots of economic power and political power get additional consideration. I have not seen a person treated as kindly as the president-elect has been treated in terms of delay after delay, in terms of being able to report in for a quick in and out booking. And he's been given every benefit of the doubt, sentencing continued. That's just the reality of our system, folks. Get over it or change the system.
And God, okay, softball question, Larry. How would we change the system?
I don't know. I don't know how we would change the system, but
wouldn't it be who we vote for? Well, elections have consequences.
Well, I don't think anybody would be willing to make the kind of draconian changes it would take to give people who are accused of crimes the level of defense that a wealthy person has. I don't think that anybody would be willing to do that.
Likely not. Moving along for your little funny segment.
This better be funny. I spent hours working on this.
I believe it. All right. Well, you have a story here under Larry's General Rules. Now, before you share your general rule for this, I'd like to read from the story. And I'm gonna like take a moment. I'm going to put the article up on the screen for everyone to kind of see what we're talking about here. Now, it says, it states, four residents from the Los Angeles area were arrested this week after an investigation by the California Department of Insurance revealed that they allegedly used a life-sized bear costume to stage attacks on their vehicles in an attempt to secure a six-figure payout. The suspects who we will not name range in age, The suspects who we will not name range in age from 26 to 39 have been charged with insurance fraud and conspiracy, according to an announcement made by the department on Wednesday. Their alleged scam cost three insurance companies a total of $141,839. The story goes on. It says a man told 911 operator a bear chased him off a cliff. Weeks later, he was arrested for murder. In January, the suspects claimed that a bear had entered their 2020 Rolls-Royce Ghost and caused interior damage while it was parked in Lake Arrowhead, a region of the San Bernardino Mountains known for its large black bear population. It's not weird, Larry. That's just silly sounding. But okay, go on.
Well, what's funny is that the suspects themselves provided video footage of the alleged incident to their unnamed insurance company, which the department has since posted online. The video shows a furry figure entering through a side door, climbing around the back seat, and crawling out, leaving scratch marks on the leather seats and door. And, quote, upon further scrutiny of the video, the investigation determined that the bear was actually a person in a bear costume, officials said.
I'm either thinking of Bigfoot videos or furry conventions, Larry. You know what furries are?
Yes.
Okay, detectives found two more claims involving the same suspects from the same date and location, but involving different cars. A 2015 Mercedes G63 AMG, whatever the heck that is, and a 2022 Mercedes E350. The suspects also provided video footage of these alleged incidents, which followed a similar pattern to the first. But suspicious authorities didn't rely solely on their animal instincts. Oh, ha, ha, ha. They took additional steps to sniff out the truth. Did you write this?
No, this is from the story.
Okay, that's really corny, but funny. The department had a biologist from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife review the three alleged bear videos, and they also opined it was clearly a human in a bear suit, it said. The Montana camper found dead was killed, but not by a bear, authorities say. Detectives executed a search warrant and found a bear costume, complete with a furry snouted head, paws, and metal tools in the shape of claws in the suspect's home. This is this is bizarre.
Well, criminals need to do more research. It was noted that the fur of the costume is light brown, a light brown color. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife says black bears are the only wild bears in the state, although they can be found in various shades, including brown and tan. The insurance department says the Glendale Police Department and the California Highway Patrol helped investigate the case, which has been referred to the San Bernardino County District Attorney's Office for prosecution.
Now that we've gotten all the comedic parts out of the way, I need to know, Larry, what is your general rule?
Well, rule number one, don't commit insurance fraud, because insurance companies are not amused by that. But if you must commit insurance fraud, make sure that you don't video your criminality. This case will be an easy win for the prosecution thanks to the evidence provided by the fraudsters themselves. They provided the video, multiple videos of them running a fake crime, you know, a fraudulent activity. Now, can you admit that this is funny?
You know what, Larry? I'm going to go with that. That's funny. That one is funny because that's funny.
So
there. So that's the first time and the only time I'm ever going to admit that anything's funny.
So it took 7 years and 3 months or whenever we started this podcast, and you finally admitted that I come up with a funny.
Yes, because someone in chat is very amused that you know what a furry is.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
Gary, now you can go like take a break because I'm going to bring John. John, are you there?
I are there.
Oh, great. Fantastic. Wait, John, you're kicking all of your audio back to me. Are we good?
Yeah. Hello.
Do we have a little bio for John? I forgot to ask that in pre.
I was just about to have to ask him to introduce himself.
Can you hear me? Is this good?
It is. I just, for a moment when I started speaking, I was hearing myself back very loud. But we will progress, and I will deal with it if it is.
Okay. Well, I'll turn down my speakers. There we go.
You're not using headphones?
They are in a box from being out of town for a week. But yes.
All right. Well, then we have to make sure that we do not at all talk over each other. And we will move on from this. But it's very important if you're ever a guest on a podcast to have headphones.
Yes.
John, can you introduce yourself, please?
I sure can. My name's John Daw. I am the managing director of the Pennsylvania Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws, or PARSOL. I am a person forced to register here in the northeastern quadrant of Pennsylvania. And happy to be here. Been a long-time follower of the show and long-time Patreon subscriber. And always happy to join you folks.
Thank you very much. I made the long trek over to Harrisburg to attend the Pennsylvania Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws conference, which was yesterday. And I was there also checking out the conference, but as a tech support role to help you out. And I attended a whole bunch of sessions. And so thank you very much for joining us here. And let's continue there from there then, please.
Yeah, Andy, thanks again for making the trip up to our conference and for all the technical help. I have to tell you, although I wasn't able to be in everything, I did listen to some of the recordings, and you asked some excellent policy questions in every session you sat in. Larry, you would have been so proud. I'll say yesterday was just a great day for PARSOL and for PFRs here in Pennsylvania. We had some awesome presenters. Our state representative, Emily Kincaid, did our lunch keynote. Brenda Jones from NARSOL came up to speak. And our executive deputy attorney general, Rob Reed, was there. I'm not sure if the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office prosecutes insurance fraud involving fake bears, but if they do, Rob's probably the guy that we would talk to about that.
Hey, let me kind of kick it off right off the bat that I was kind of stunned at his informality, that people were just like, so Rob, I have a question. I was like, I don't think that you're supposed to address this guy as just Rob, but that he seemed perfectly okay with people just saying Rob.
Yeah, he's great. And you know, I said we had a very interesting day in that people are like, you've invited the second highest chief law enforcement officer in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to keynote your conference. And then he gave his presentation and everybody found out why. He's on board, and he shared that. And I think you've got a clip in a little bit of some of the things that he said, but awesome.
I do. And if, would you do me a favor and set things up? You can certainly follow from the notes that I have prepared, because sure. I was preparing you not to be here because you said you weren't going to be, and then last minute you were here. But
I got home early, so yes.
So the day before, Thursday, there was a re-entry conference that kind of you piggybacked on, which I think helped in having some of the different people available, that they were kind of already in the neighborhood.
Absolutely. PARSOL's been wanting to do a conference of this type for some time, and we wanted to do it in our capital city of Harrisburg. I sit on the Pennsylvania Reentry Council, and when I found out that PARC was doing a conference, I found out early this year, and I said, great, we're going to take the next day and do ours. So that was real helpful. And we invited Rob to speak. His talk centered on providing trauma-informed approaches in criminal legal system reform and reentry efforts. He chairs the Pennsylvania Reentry Council. And his emphasis was on empathy, safety, and humanity. He talked about trauma-informed systems, and that is the importance of integrating trauma-informed practices in corrections, policing, courts, and community services, which both foster healing and reduce recidivism. He talked about reentry support, which, as I mentioned, he chairs PARC, the Pennsylvania Reentry Council, which facilitates collaboration among different organizations across the Commonwealth. More than half of our 67 counties have reentry coalitions in them as a result. And they work to address barriers to housing, employment, family reunification, and those reentering society post-incarceration. He talked about community engagement, encouraging people to participate in PARC and the HEAL PA trauma-informed initiatives to build a more compassionate and humane society. He talked about personal well-being and self-care and managing stress and how managing stress can help maintain safety and supportive relationships. And he talked about scam awareness. We all know that PFRs, because information like your home address, your employer, contact information is listed on a public website, it's a ripe place for scammers. I'm not sure if they're dressed in bear outfits or not. But
yeah, watch out for the ones that are wearing bear outfits. He mentioned during his presentation that at least he wasn't, I don't know if the whole office wasn't really aware of the level of scamminess that PFRs are faced with, but you brought that to his attention fairly recently?
Yeah, we've been working together for over a year, but we finally got a chance to have a one-on-one when he said, well, what do you want me to talk about at your conference, and why am I being invited? And I said, well, one of the areas that the AG's office has frankly fallen short on is responding to these scams. Their biggest scam department is for senior citizens, which is, of course, a vulnerable population who falls prey to scammers and whatnot. And his response to me was, well, people on the registry are another very vulnerable population. So why aren't we doing something about it? And we have created in the last couple weeks, as a result of that conversation, a form on parcel.org. Please, if you're not in Pennsylvania, don't use our form. But if you are in Pennsylvania and you have a scam or an attempted scam, you can fill out the form on parcel.org, the big button at the top of the website, report a scam. And that form will go to us, because we track them and log them, but it'll also now go to Rob's direct email. It will go to folks in the AG's office, and Rob has promised to make sure they actually follow up on them, and we've actually had someone who filled that out who's already gotten a call from someone at the AG's office to follow up on that. I think his big thing is, this isn't just a scam. These people are committing a crime. And as the law enforcement entity in Pennsylvania, the AG's office has a responsibility to follow up on that.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Larry, would you imagine that that is a fairly unique position in the United States?
The position of the Deputy Attorney General, is that what the question is?
Yeah, about I'm sure they would take a call and report it and take the report of there being a fraudulent angle, but it seems like they're going to at least set up somebody that is aware that this is a regular thing for PFRs.
Well, let me tell you what the real situation is. If you've ever checked the voter rolls and the voter participation, senior citizens vote at a very, very high rate.
Certainly.
PFRs vote at a much, much lower rate.
Right.
So
both in proportion and in quantity.
So in the reality of political analysis, when you're setting up your governmental agency to provide service to constituents, you're trying to get the biggest bang for your buck that you can. And taking care of seniors and children has a pretty good return on investment from the voters. Serving PFRs has a much lower rate of return. from political analysis, you look at that and you say, well, I tell you what I'm going to do if I'm the Attorney General. I'm going to make sure that anybody on the registry gets well protected by this office. Not going to get a lot of votes. So that's the reason for where it's not a high priority.
I understand.
Boy, when you said he was Mr. Doom and Gloom, you were right.
Oh, well, no doubt, dude. He will flush anything that you think is a positive angle. He's whoosh. I should change his picture to be a toilet, because whatever you say, he's going to flush. Just saying. Well, after he was finished with his question, they opened it up, and I had the opportunity to ask him a question, which I do think that you will appreciate, Larry. And since he's like pretty high up there as the head prosecutor of the state, he mentioned a whole bunch of different groups that are involved in this trauma-focused criminal justice reform, whatever they're going after. But he left out prosecutors, and I couldn't help myself to ask. I said, Mr. Reed, because I addressed him as such and not Rob, prosecutors often control, so this is me asking him, prosecutors often control key aspects of the justice system, such as deciding who gets prosecuted, the charges filed, and even the timeline of the cases. Their incentives, however, often seem to favor more prosecution is better, a mindset that influences public perception as well. How can we shift both the prosecutorial incentive structure and public attitudes to prioritize justice over sheer volume? And I have a clip of his response.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good question. I was a prosecutor for, as I say, more than three decades. Prosecutors are hard. The DAs are elected. People working for them are not. Lancaster County, actually, I spoke to every lawyer in the office about trauma. So I did do that. Prosecutors are somewhat removed from the hands-on stuff of the people who are committing crimes. They see themselves as above. But things are changing even there. The Attorney General's office in Pennsylvania is the only one in the United States that has a reentry coalition.
And then he moved on to another question and so on. But I'd love to get your thoughts, Larry, on, first of all, how did I do as a question? And then also his reply.
Well, it was a great question. And he did what typically happens. He did a less than complete answer.
Right.
How is that, John? I'm being nice. He did a less than complete answer.
Well, maybe we're just gloom and not so much doom.
You'll notice, though, at the end, though, his final thought was plugging that they're the only state. And I don't know if that's true or not, but he said that they're the only state with a reentry coalition.
I want to clear. It's a reentry council.
Sorry, council coalition. Yes.
So in Pennsylvania, the reentry coalitions are in the counties, but the reentry council is a statewide group that pulls more than just a single county's resources together, but state programs and groups like Parsol, who we are one of the committees. So,
well, let me ask you this question directly.
Question about this that he didn't answer. The answer to your question is, how can we shift prosecutorial incentive structure and public attitudes to prioritize justice over sheer volume? Well, we just went through, what is it, a little over a week ago on November 5th, we went through an exercise.
Yes.
And that's how we make that change. But the people said loud and clear, they threw District Attorney George Gascon out in Los Angeles because he was too pointy in his head. And so the people have made it loud and clear that they want sheer volume. They want people in prison. They want these things. Now, there may be pockets around the country, maybe in Philadelphia with Krasner, there may be some exceptions. But the people have made it clear that this is what they want. But in terms of your buildup and your question, you're correct. The prosecutors do control what charges they file. The police and law enforcement recommend. The prosecutor's office makes the choice if they feel they have sufficient evidence. They run the machinery that generates the formal charges and the indictments. They determine the severity and how many counts they stack. They determine how quickly the case moves forward. The prosecution is never, ever denied a continuance. If they put forth a motion saying that a case should be continued because of a heavy docket, it is granted. If they put forth a motion to dismiss, or actually don't have to file a motion, they can file a nulli prosequi, and they can dismiss the charges. They have complete control to dismiss the charge at any time they want to. So he, of course, didn't say those things because those things don't sell very well politically. He's in a political environment. Cut him some slack. The attorney general has to be elected. Cut him some slack. So he's not going to say these type of things as a direct answer. He'll either dodge the question or redirect the question to something else about a reentry counsel that was not a part of your question.
I like, you mentioned all these other groups, but you forgot this one, but he didn't answer about that one.
Well, he didn't answer hardly anything about the question. But see, when people do that, it sounds so good and smooth that most of the people forget the question.
Yep.
And that's routine, and politicians have learned that. And then you get, there's a pushback when you say, well, I'd like to redirect you to the question, Mr. President. That's a nasty question. Your tone is horrible. But yeah, he didn't really thoroughly answer the question. I would have said, yes, we do control all those things. And here's the problem we have, is we have how many millions of voters in Pennsylvania? They are convinced that the crime is rampant and out of control, and that we're being too soft on crime. So yes, we have to push for volume. I can't stand here before the public and say we want to reduce the volume of prosecutions when people think crime is out of control. How long would we be in office?
Yeah, I want to just clarify, you know, it was not our AG, it was our deputy AG, but I agree with your sentiment. I would say that at the reentry conference the day before, the district attorney-elect of York County spoke, and one of the things that he said, which was very odd to hear a prosecutor say, is we are not always on board with these reentry efforts. We are not always on board with these programs because we are not invited to the table until they're rolled out and nobody listens to our input. I'm not sure that their input would align with the program goals, but it's a fair statement that, you know, if you're going to plan, and this happens to PFRs all the time, if you're going to plan how their treatment is going to be and tell them that's how that's going to be and not involve them in that or not take into consideration specific ideas or thoughts that they may have, then of course they're not going to have full buy-in because they weren't part of the conversation from an early stance. So it was odd to hear a DA say, you know, that they're willing to sit down with any of the reform groups or any of the justice reform organizations and have a seat at that table. And I'm not sure that we would necessarily think to invite them to that table, but now we are.
So. Well, John, I realize he's not the attorney general, but when you're that high up, you are effectively a politician. Sure. Because you don't get appointed for the high level managerial post in these bureaucracies unless you're very politically savvy. So he's thinking, yep, exactly like the attorney general would be thinking. But yeah, I recognize he's not the AG.
Yeah. Well, Larry, shall we continue?
Sure. We can continue. Who was the next speaker at this fabulous, and what was the fabulous event, and what was the focus of that session?
The next session that I attended was that of Dr. Stephanie Gerstadt, and she was, go on.
I'm not sure if I recognize the name. I may be vaguely familiar. Who is that?
So she was a guest on NARSAL's, the program NARSAL in Action, and that was in September. And Dr. Gerstadt's focus was on the aging population of PFRs, your contemporaries. And the picture she painted was pretty bleak.
Well, we've talked about that, but what is the big issue as Dr. Gerstadt sees it?
So I never really kind of put this together, but the registry's been around for several decades now. And if someone was put on the registry, kind of like, hey, super patron Mike, I'm kind of shooting cannons at you, but in their 20s or 30s, back in the 90s, and now they're 50s, 60s, or even older, they're starting to hit the point in life where they might need assisted living, a retirement home, or something like that.
Well, John, why can't they just stay in an assisted living like everyone else. I mean, these are private businesses many times. What's the problem?
Well, and that's part of the problem. In some states, there are even laws that outright bar PFRs from certain housing options, including retirement homes or long-term care facilities like nursing homes. In Pennsylvania, there's no residency restriction law like that, but many nursing homes have blanket policies that prohibit PFRs from living there. And they cite a number of reasons for that, you know, beyond the fact that they say, well, it might be unsafe for someone. They are often responsible for transportation. And if you're a PFR in Pennsylvania that needs to register every month, is the nursing home going to, they'll say they don't want to provide a ride for a resident to go to the Pennsylvania State Police Barracks, which even for, you know, Pennsylvania's in portions outside of the urban centers, very rural. So you might be going an hour away to register, and they don't want to take their residents there to sit in a waiting room for 3 hours while the state police get around to doing their registration.
Well, one thing that Dr. Gerstad shared was that even someone with dementia, like that case you talked about in New Mexico, that we've talked about for the last couple episodes, they might be ineligible because of their status on the registry.
Well, what happens to these people then?
Isn't that the million-dollar question, Larry?
Well, it'd be helpful if they had $1 million, but people impacted by the criminal legal system, number one, they're not going to usually have enough surplus cash to hire a private in-home care. They've most likely lived paycheck to paycheck or struggled financially after being released from prison. If they're a lifetime SVP resident, registrant in Pennsylvania, you know, they're paying monthly treatment and therapy bills. And I think that as the baby boomer generation ages into the need for long-term care, as Andy had said, you know, that person, that's the generation that was first largely impacted by the registry. And there's just a growing crisis and a huge population of elderly people with nowhere to go. It's a ticking time bomb.
Well, is there any precedent for this? I mean, what do we have to go on?
Well, unfortunately, yes. And Dr. Gerstad did her doctoral dissertation on this and knows that we've been seeing this issue pop up across the country. People are aging out of independent living, and the system isn't designed to support them.
And it's not just about housing. It's about dignity and basic human rights. I know it's heavy stuff, right? But these are the conversations that we need to have. And if we don't address this now, we're going to find ourselves facing a humanitarian crisis that no one is prepared for. And I'd say a huge thanks to Dr. Stephanie Gerstad for shedding light on this issue.
So, well, me too. That's something I've pontificated about. In fact, I've got language trying to exempt PFRs from in-person reporting based on their age and physical condition. And now I'm going to add mental health because of the case I'm working on currently. So thanks to her. And what session did you attend after that? In pre-show, you said something about the Good Lives model of treatment. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, me neither. I hadn't really, I guess I kind of experienced it. But so that was the one, and it was really interesting. And it was hosted by Dr. Jennifer Weeks. And she broke down this whole approach of offender rehabilitation. And it's called the Good Lives Model. And so you've never heard of it. I thought you knew everything.
Nope, not this until you told me about it. Sounds, well, what's the word? Fancy?
Yes, fancy. But actually, it's really practical. John, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think Dr. Weeks did it West. She said, so everybody has needs, right? We're talking both basic human, what I'll call survival needs, like your food, clothing, shelter. And then what Dr. Weeks described as living needs. So you're beyond surviving, you're actually living your life. And the Good Lives model states that a reason someone gets tangled up in crime, like serious stuff, even sexual offenses, you don't just try to stop the bad behavior, You have to find ways to fulfill their needs in what the model framers would call non-criminogenic ways, so you can actually live and not just survive.
And the goal is to help people build a life that's meaningful and, you know, like worth living and not just surviving, as we were just talking about paycheck to paycheck.
So you're saying instead of just punishing people or telling them don't do that, you help them get a life and actually want to live that life. Is that it?
That nailed it. And it's about replacing those unhealthy coping mechanisms with pro-social, aka positive ones. Like instead of turning to destructive behavior or criminality to deal with stress, they learn healthier ways to cope. Things that make them feel good but aren't, you know, harmful.
Well, I like that. But how does that even work? What's the process?
Great question. So Dr. Weeks explained that it's what's called a strengths-based model. So instead of focusing just on what's wrong with something, such as you're a loser, you'll never amount to anything, something that a previous treatment provider said to me, you dig into what they're good at and what they care about and what their goals are, and you help build on that to create a life where crime doesn't make sense anymore. And one of the messages, so I do a lot of lobbying for Parsol, and one of the things that's been extremely effective when talking with people at all levels of policy and government here in PA is to point out that the huge, we're talking tens of millions of dollars in resources and information that we've poured into the opioid epidemic and the treatment of substance misuse. We know that people's story, we hear this all the time at conferences and presentations, about person X who encounters adversity and trauma, you know, my mother never loved me, my father abused me, whatever. And that person X discovers that they can escape their feelings through the use of alcohol or other drugs, usually in their early teens. Now, and then we turn it to person Y, who has a similar story, but in order for them to feel better, they turn to pornography or sexual activities. And the answer is the treatment and the needs are the same. And when I've said this to top level representatives in our state house, in our administration here in Pennsylvania, it opens their minds to looking at sexual offending in a way that they're used to, because let's face it, the substance abuse treatment lobby and substance abuse community is a lot more vocal with a lot more money and a lot more power than the PFR community. And the Good Lives model says we need to replace these unhealthy coping mechanisms or harmful coping mechanisms with healthy options feed and are driven by a person's passions and what they're passionate about.
Oh, this is starting to make sense. So if someone is really into art, you'd encourage them to lean into and maybe make a career or hobby out of it instead of doing something illegal.
Exactly. And it's about helping them build a fulfilling life that's meaningful to them. And that's what's cool, and it just isn't for offenders. Non-offenders can use the same or similar principles to build better lives as well.
Okay, but how does it connect to the other thing you mentioned, the risk needs responsivity thingy?
Right. The risk needs responsivity model, or RNR, is more about assessing risk and targeting specific needs to reduce offending. The Good Lives model actually supports that, because by helping people meet their personal goals in a positive way, you're also addressing their risks and needs. It's like they complement each other.
Makes sense, kind of, but I'm kind of challenged on some of the stuff. So bottom line, what's the big takeaway from that workshop?
Well, I'd say it's something that everyone could get something out of, and it's not just for PFRs or other offenders. They can use these ideas to create a life that's more satisfying and meaningful. Maybe, Larry, you should try and figure out some hobbies, you know, yourself. But you can focus on what's important to you, build your strengths, and let go of the stuff that's holding you back.
Well, did she say anything else interesting?
Yeah, she explicitly said if someone fails a polygraph, She doesn't recommend that they are violated. She gets the feedback from the Kabuki machine operator and uses that feedback to figure out what they might need to focus on in treatment. Now, what was interesting as a coincidence here, Larry, there was a guy named Ryan, and I'm certain you're not going to remember him, but he listened to the show about 5 or 6 years ago, and he was listening to it before he was going off to prison in Florida. And he had reached out to me on my drive over to Pennsylvania, and he texted me and said, "Hey, is it okay for your treatment provider to berate you and cuss you out?" And I shared that information with Dr. Weeks, and she said that he should probably try to change providers. But the question to ask if that behavior is okay, which the answer is never, never going to be an okay answer. But however, if that's your only option, you just might kind of have to be stuck with it and deal with it as best you can, which is just really ultimately shitty. But her approach to treatment, which most of us, at least in this context, is just a total scam. I find that her model, I didn't get a chance to ask her the question, but since she's a PhD and has done research on this, I wanted to ask her if the comparison of someone that has lesser training, a master's degree in like counseling or something like that, I don't think that they're approaching it with the same sort of mindset that she is, but her approach seemed incredibly refreshing to me.
It does to me. I love it. Who doesn't want a better life? And thanks for breaking this down.
Anytime. So big shout out also to Dr. Jennifer Weeks for the workshop. It was really an eye opener. It was cool. Thank you, John, very much. I appreciate you doing the do, man, and coming on short notice.
No problem. Thank you again for coming out to PA and helping with the tech and all that, and your support of Parsol over the years. One thing I would just mention about Dr. Weeks is she is also a CSAT, which is a Certified Sexual Addiction Therapist, or CSAT, and I think that gives her a unique perspective on the issue as well. So if people are looking for a supportive treatment provider, they might look for someone in their area with a CSAT after their name.
Sweet. How can people find Parsol?
They can find them on the internet, Andy.
Just Google it. John, did you already like kick out? Can't hear you. Well, go to parsol.org. I think he may have already just checked out, or he had a heart attack.
John? Sorry about that. I tried to use a headset and it battery died. So, people can get more information about us at parsol.org, parsol.org. Or if you're allowed on social media, you can usually find us at @parsolofficial.
Fantastic. Thank you again for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Larry, we were kind of having a little background conversation that it's already 50 minutes in and we're not going to have time to cover this New Mexico thing that you wanted to bring up.
That's fine. It'll be carried over to next week. We will be here next week. And then the following weekend, we probably will not be here because it's Thanksgiving weekend. But we'll just have some content from New Mexico for next weekend about the legislative outlook.
I swear, Larry, I got into an argument with some people earlier today. I swear that Thanksgiving is on the third Thursday. I swear it's on the third Thursday. But I was shown to be inaccurate in that information, and it's actually the fourth. Just saying.
Well, that's good. We'll have another lovely episode next weekend, and then we'll get a break.
Very well. Any closing words that you would like to share with the audience before we turn off the recorders?
I think I've got it covered. We've done a great episode, and I'm looking forward to feedback about the PA conference, because we need to be doing more of these around the country.
So let me just throw this at you. It's from my perspective, Larry, it's wonderful that there's a national organization, a NARSOL kind of place, but I'm still pretty convinced that the majority of the changes are going to have to be done at the local level, at your state level. And so then we would need to have people at your state capital and potentially having conferences like this. It was like, I, it's great to have Narsal to maybe like help with funding legal suits and things of that nature, but it still has to come down to your local state that you need to organize and go. Even like the guy in South Carolina, he has been a lone wolf for a bazillion years, and he goes to the Capitol and he goes to talk to people. You don't need an organization necessarily. You just need people that'll go do it.
You're correct. The real action is at the states.
Very well. That was a pretty short and concise there, Larry.
I'm trying to get out of here. I've got a hot date.
Oh, I see. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. There were a whole mess of people in chat, and I appreciate everyone coming. And we will see you in a week. Have a great night, Larry.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.